This is the beginning of Class 6.
What did you say went to the paradise? Was it my
Asanga.
Asanga.
Vasubandhu's half brother. Mother was the nun. Asanga. Asibanda's half brother. Mother was a nun. It's not a tantra, it's called tantra, okay? It's just, Vajana Tantra means higher line, higher lineage. That's the name of his book, Higher Line. I'm not quite sure what higher line is.
So he went to a heaven and
met Maitreya there. He went to Maitreya, and Maitreya dictated to him five great books.
And they are?
And Rintogen, which is...
I mean, anything we're going to study or anything?
You studied already parts of the first one. And this one is very popular. It's not one of the great five books that I've studied in the monastery, but it's a very great text. So actually, we're going to talk about that text right now.
That's by Vasubandhu?
Asanga. Well, Asanga was the scribe. Maitreya was the author.
Can you go through the whole...
Maitreya lived in a paradise. And Asanga went to that paradise, and Maitreya dictated to him five great books, of which... This thing called the higher line, Gyu Lama, is one of them.
And Maitreya is the
Maitreya
Buddha
is the coming Buddha. He's the body, the Buddha of the future. And now, whether or not he's a Buddha already is a big debate in the monastery.
Whether he's a Buddha already means a living being now.
According to some points of view, he's already a Buddha.
Living
according
now.
To some other points of view, yeah, he's a body now. And according
in
to
a regular body or in another
no,
body?
No, in a
paradise. Oh.
And some people say he's not yet a Buddha. Some people say he's going to be a Buddha. He'll be the next Buddha.
So it could be one of us.
Could be. Yeah.
So this is Chandakirti commentating on Guam. Is that what
No, no, no. No connection between the two.
So it's just Guam is up there.
The reason Guam is up here is that I want to give you a little reading from Guam, which appears in a commentary to Chandakirti. What you're going to get right now is from Gyu Lama. And we'll go back to Chandakirti later.
And so what is Gyu Lama?
Gyu Lama is the higher line. It's a book about emptiness, mainly. And it's written by Maitreya.
Oh, so it's the same as Uttara
Tantra?
Uttara
Tantra is the Sanskrit name.
Okay.
And it's not a tantric work. The word tantra means many other things. Tantra means life. Like the sacred thread that a Brahmin wears here is a tantra.
How do you spell
the fair you're asking that.
A-S-A-N.
It means tokme. Tokme means a negative in Sanskrit. Sangha means you hit something. If you have very good wisdom, it cuts through knowledge. It cuts through knowable things like a hot knife and butter. Nothing can stop it. Anyway, like a hot knife to butter. I can't think of any other word in English. That's what his name is. Okay, what did he write? He wrote a very beautiful description. Asanga. I'm sorry, Asanga wrote it down. Maitreya spoke it. Right? Which appears in the Uttara Tantra, the Gyu Lama, the higher life. Asanga went to that paradise and met Maitreya. Western scholars go crazy trying to date all of it because they don't know what's going on.
I think
they don't know what's going on. Okay, so he wrote that he wrote a lot about the relationship between emptiness and karma. And so I want to give you a little bit about. There's a very famous section from him. It's in your reading. It's in the first few pages of your reading. And he describes how karma is created by a lack of understanding of emptiness. And I'm going to go through that with you. He describes six steps. And he gives it six steps. It's sort of a chain reaction. He says, if you have this, you have this. If you have this, you have this. If you have this, you have this. The first of them is a bhakta.
When you say how karma is created, you mean bad karma is created through lack of emptiness?
Both, actually.
What are these again?
Six steps of how, well, you'll see, of how emptiness and karma are related. How they cause trouble. So, bhakta. What's a bhakta? You know already.
Mental seed.
A mental seed. There can be a couple of kinds. You had one about, you had a leggy bhakta. What's a leg?
Karma.
We were talking about karmic bhakta. There's also ignorance bhakta. Okay, much different, right? A leggy bhakta planted in your brain is going to sprout up as what?
A label?
Well, a good experience or a bad experience. Mm-hmm. An ignorance bhakta, if it springs up, is going to create what? Suppose there's been some latent seed in your mind for a kind of ignorance. When the bhakshak grows, and then what happens? You take something to be self-existent. You take something to have a real self, to have a real nature. We'll talk about what that means. So it all starts with the bhakshak. Where does the bhakshak come from?
Deep.
It's not a karmic bhakshak, really. It's more of a, well, ultimately, yeah, but it really comes from your past lives. I mean, you've been carrying that bhakshak for many jillions of lives. And we saw that in the last course. If you can prove one most previous life, then the lives are endless, beginningless. So you've had that bhakshak for time without beginning.
Now, what is this bhakshak?
Is it physical or mental? It's in between. Okay. And according to Buddhism, there's three kinds of changing objects. Physical objects, mental objects, and those changing things which are neither physical nor mental. And that's the name of it, Dhammaduchi. And you know, scholars go crazy trying to translate that word. But it means, examples are Fran. Okay. Fran is neither Fran's mind or Fran's body. Fran is a concept. And this is an energy. It's a kind of energy that resides. We talked about it last class. We had a long talk about that. But it resides with you, and it ripens at a certain time, and then you get that either result of karma, if it's a karmic bhakti, or you get what? You get manifestations of ignorance in your mind, if it was a bhakti for ignorance.
Are you saying it's a concept, like Fran is a concept?
No, I'm saying that's Fran, or John, is one example of a changing thing which is neither physical nor mental. And a bhakti is another example. If you want to know where to categorize bhakshak, there's a big debate about it. They say in the mind, we talked about it last week. Okay, so first you have a bhakshak for that kind of ignorance, all right? There's two kinds of ignorance, and those two kinds of ignorance come out. That's number two.
Michael, are you just happening to choose ignorance as an example, or is this how it works for all situations?
By the time I get to the thing.
Your pen is not working.
That's a good one. These are two kinds of ignorance, okay, and you should know them. You don't have to know them to bad news. Say, Kazaki, Dangzin, and Chugyi Dangzin. Dangzin is a very important word. Dangzin means, that means self. Zin means to grasp. And so Dangzin is the tendency to grasp to self. The tendency to grasp to self. Is that good enough? Is that a bad thing? Is that ignorance?
Yeah.
Someone steals the Buddha's begging bowl, does it say someone stole my bowl?
Yeah.
Okay. So you have to clarify it a little bit, right? It's not wrong to think that you're yourself. Of course you're yourself. That's a sema, that's a common, right? You are yourself. Dangzin holds that self to be truly existing the way it seems to be.
How would you describe the whole thing?
Didn't get to that yet. Gansa means me, person. Gansa means person. So this translates out as this kind of ignorance, the first kind of ignorance, translates as the tendency to grasp to a self nature of the person. The tendency to grasp to some self nature of the person. The reason we say some self nature is that there's no such thing. It's grasping something about me which is false.
And self-existent nature? You say self-nature?
You can say self-existent nature. I mean, when people say that Buddhists deny the self, they deny the Atman, they believe in Anatman, it doesn't mean, you know, obviously you're here. You can't deny it. It'd be silly. It'd be stupid. And that's why people attract their brains trying to figure it out. It sounds very mysterious, right? It attracts a lot of people to Buddhism. Of course you're here. Of course you're there. Of course you have it. You are yourself. And in the word Atman or Dak, you know, the chair is itself, the wall is itself, the building is itself, that's all okay. Dangzin means to grasp to some self that doesn't exist. Self-nature.
Are you talking about interdependence?
Later. Of me, okay? It grasps to some self-existence of me. It focuses on who? Your Gansaki Dangzin focuses on you. Yours focuses on you, yours focuses on you. This is focusing on yourself and interpreting yourself to be self-existent. Self-existent means not being independent, being arising. That word itself has four different interpretations. Okay? at different levels of sophistication, and we saw that in the first course. That's a long story. But basically, it looks at me, and it takes me to be self-existent. What does that mean? What would that be like? In the case of the guy at work.
Best boss you could ever hope for. The best boss you could ever hope for.
Right? No, I mean, let's say it focuses on you. You don't like something about yourself. And, well, we're going to talk about it. Anyway, it focuses on you. And it has some kind of wrong idea about you. That's what Gosaki does. It thinks, it believes that you have some kind of self-existence. We don't know what that is yet. Chugi Dangzin means the tendency to grasp to a self nature of dharma, and in this case, it's very important to understand that dharma means dharma, which generally means all existing phenomena, or also means the teaching of the Buddha. In this case, means something totally different. It means the things that belong to you.
Of your things.
Your nose. Your ear, your mind, your legs. So the first kind of ignorance is focusing on what?
Yourself.
John Stilwell. By John Stilwell. And Helen Crispell is focusing on Helen Crispell. And this one is focusing, for John, it's focusing on John's hand, John's legs, John's own mind, John's eyes. And for other people, it's focusing on the other parts of their own parts of their body.
So one is the whole? One is the whole and one is the parts?
You could say that. What is more, what is me and the rest is mine. I mean mine, we have this song.
So my house too? I mean, it's
yeah, normally it's restricted to parts of yourself.
It's not belonging. I mean, like...
It's defined as naiwa, which means what belongs to you.
But
then it says, all the examples it gives are personal parts of you. You know, like your mind, your nose, your ears, your body, your thoughts. You know, so that it's pretty much focused on you. This is the one that gives you the most trouble. When you reach Toma, when you see emptiness for the first time, it is the emptiness of yourself. And when you come out of that, you'll say, oh gee, when I become a Buddha, they won't call me my Buddha. Some kind of understanding about self that you have. And so it's directed. What the first time that you perceive emptiness directly is, it's concerning yourself. So what's happening so far? You're carrying a seed for those two kinds of misperceptions from your past lives. And then in this life, they start to grow. These two things start to grow.
What is
these
this?
Two kinds of ignorance. These are the main two kinds of ignorance that even exist in the world. There's other kinds of ignorance, like about karma and stuff like that. But when you talk about the ignorance that causes suffering, this is it. It's one of these two. Yeah.
What about the ignorance
that these
other people are talking about?
That's not the first link of Buddha's life. There is such an ignorance, you know, that focuses on Janet's eye. And there's some monastic scriptures that say, well, that's a kind of grasping to self because it's someone else's self. But mainly, just think of that. The main emptiness that you don't understand, and the one that's going to get you in trouble, is the emptiness of yourself.
What is the source of the original bok-chok of ignorance?
The last ignorance that you had in your last mind.
Self-existent perception?
Yeah, the idea that things have their own nature. And those came from their own bok-choks, and those bok-choks came from something else, but you know, there's no end. There's no beginning, actually. And you saw in the last class that we had that if the proofs for future lives are correct, then there was a past life. And if there was one past life, because what triggers a life is the life before it, it has to be beginningless. We don't believe in Buddhism that your mind had any beginning. You can't point to a point in time and say your mind began at that time. You can't. Because as a near-linked you, the material cause, the thing that turns into mind, has to be the mind of the moment before.
Are these thought chunks cumulative?
The anywhere now that you were a million years ago. I don't remember seeing that. You know, you can have bad million year spans when you're really down and you're really sick, you know. And I think they just go like that, you know. They're always strong enough to keep you in this suffering life. But I think they would or like depending on whether you met a teacher or not, or whether you had any exposure to other ideas. And, but I don't see this kind of cosmic thing where they get worse as the eons go on. They seem to go up and down.
Could you give a definition of Chukyi Dangten?
Chukyi Dangten, I'll give you the technical definition.
Oh, so glad somebody has. I lost the paper.
Anyway, Naiyawala Mingne, focusing on the part system, or what you call mind. Gemba Drupa Zinne, law. The state of mind which believes that thing to be self-existent. Those objects to be self-existent. What self-existent means is a big story. So anyway, these two are the ones that cause you trouble. These two are the first link of the wheel of life.
Yeah. By saying that it's beginningless, the causes for these, or it came from the previous one, that sounds like it precludes a state that any mind ever had before, where it was without ignorance, and then it sort of fell into ignorance or something.
Yeah, right.
Like that.
No, we've never not had ignorance. We wouldn't be here.
Either that, or we came here voluntarily.
Yeah. Sure. Okay. All right. Number three.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Are you saying that all minds have ignorance from the very beginning? The mind, came into existence,
yeah.
If you want to say that.
It never started.
It had no beginning, and it was with ignorance.
Yeah.
Always.
The mind has always had ignorance. You've always perceived in the wrong way. When you see emptiness for the first time, you'll realize that every perception you've ever had in your life was just there. Every few minutes, every few seconds, every millisecond of perception you ever had was just there. Yeah.
Assuming that maybe a life forms that are less dense than humans.
Excuse me?
Assuming there's a life forms that are less dense than humans.
They're not.
They're not? They're not either.
Not according to Buddhism. Humans are in the best shape. There are pleasure beings above us, so physically they have more fun. But because they're having so much fun, they can't think as clearly as we do. The suffering with which our life is spiced keeps us sharp. So supposedly the best thing to be born is as a human.
And what if you're not, let me ask you another question. What if there are beings that are not human, per se, that...
Well, there's six realms. Every being in the universe has to fall into such a thing. So according to Buddhism, according to the omniscient Buddha, who sees all universes and all planets.
Okay, so maybe if there's life on other planets and there are...
There is. There's whole maps of them in the Abhidhamma.
Okay, so these people would be considered human now?
If they... We're actually going to talk about that later.
All right.
It'll be very interesting. Okay.
Number two.
Because
there was two.
Mm-hmm.
Low Chintilok is backwards.
Yeah. And it focuses on two things. It focuses on pleasant experiences, and it focuses on unpleasant experiences. Now, how is it Chintilok? What do you think? Remember to keep some kind of a flow between what's happening before.
We're attracted to pleasure.
Not yet. It's just misperceiving pleasure and pain. But what's it thinking about the pleasure? What's it thinking about the guy at the office?
It's good and it's permanent, the pleasure.
It's
more
profound than that.
Self-existent.
It's real.
Yeah, well, it's real or else you wouldn't be. We're going to go into that later. That's self-existent. What does self-existent mean here is that it exists. This is the ultimate meaning of self-existent. And there's many other meanings of self-existent. And you have to learn all of them in the lower schools. The higher school, the highest viewpoint is that the thing is self-existent. If it exists without my conceiving of it and creating it anyway by my conception. If it exists independent of the process of me conceptualizing, then it's self-existent. So that's the next step. You had a seed for ignorance, and then ignorance grows in your mind, and then ignorance focuses on pleasant things and unpleasant things, and thinks of them the wrong way. It thinks that if the guy at work yells at me, then that what I should do to remove that unpleasantness is to yell back and somehow overcome him, and then he'll leave, and then that's what caused him to get out of my life. You know? That's ignorance. That's a chinchi mo. Okay? To perceive him as being something outside of my, a product of my own karma and my own conception. And it's my own problem. And it has nothing to do with yelling at him. You know, it's totally unconnected. The ignorant thing to do is to respond. It's totally no relation. If you do something and get rid of him, or if you do something and it doesn't get rid of him, which you know happens, both of them happen, so it doesn't work, right? You say something or you do something. This is chinchiko. The perception of him is the perception you have of everything in your life. You think it's pleasant or unpleasant in its by its own nature, and not because of your own projection.
Would you give a little small definition for that? Like one?
Yeah, I would say just that these are all processes of a, these are all steps of a long process by which you get screwed up. Okay. You have a seed in your mind when you're born for ignorance. Ignorance becomes, what do you call it? Manifest in your mind. It grows. It springs up in your mind. You look at pleasant objects and unpleasant objects and take them the wrong way. That's chinchi mo. Very, very simple. What's happening so far? Very simple. You have it about every object in your life, especially pleasant and unpleasant objects. You respond to them totally wrong. You have a totally wrong perception. If you get something pleasant, my God, give it away to somebody. That's how to keep it. If you want more, if you like it, give it away, you know. Cause it for other people, you know, serve other people. That's the road to pleasure. It's the moment you consume it, you've screwed up. Okay.
Michael?
Yeah.
I had a lot of trouble with understanding the mind only school.
That was kind of cool, actually.
Of karma, but I don't understand, like, what do they say about interdependence and how would they define
self-existence? That's a long story. Yeah. They define emptiness, and this is not to do with tonight's class, but just for you, as the absence of a separate seed for the perceiver and the perceived thing. That's emptiness in that sense. The absence of any separate seed between that creates the perceiver and the perceived thing is emptiness. And that makes sense. Because their big deal is that, you know, I did a good karma. So my visual consciousness now has been created by that seed of that karma. And I'm watching you. And if I enjoy it, then they're both created by the same karmic seed. A good karma. And you're not out there. You're part of my own mind that I'm looking at. That's the mind only. And for me to believe that those two things are not produced by the same bhakcha growing out of the laya vijnana is to hold it to be self-existent.
And
that causes me trouble.
How do they explain interdependence?
That's a long story. That's the main meaning of interdependence. But I'll show you a book about it. There's four great interpretations of interdependence. We did them in the first course. We'll do them again sometime. You must know those things. Otherwise, you take a lower interpretation of interdependence to be the ultimate one, and you try to base your behavior on that, and it doesn't work. I mean, people say to you, what was this argument? You know, people said to me, oh, you shouldn't be attracted to girls because they're just atoms, you know. But that's their interdependence. You know? Well, it didn't help me, you know. I know they're just atoms, but I still have this problem, you know. So I don't, you know, it didn't help me. I didn't understand how that was supposed to, I understand that she grew from the food that she ate, and I understand that she's all carbon atoms, and I understand that she dyed her hair, or she's wearing some makeup, or she's wearing those clothes. And I understand that they're all artificial and that they're all interdependent, but they still look attractive to me. I don't see, you know, that doesn't help me remove my desire. There's something else. That is one lower explanation of interdependence, but it doesn't help me. And you have to know the higher one. Okay. So lo chinchi lo is where you take those pleasant and unpleasant things the wrong way. You think they are just happening. They're actually your projections on a blank screen.
So if you write somebody, you have somebody you have to deal with, who's, for instance, incompetent.
Yeah.
Quote unquote.
He's a what?
He's quote unquote incompetent.
Yeah.
Or, for instance. And you write him off as being incompetent, and you get them fired. That's not.
It's like this.
No, I mean, this is your.
They're not interrelated? I mean, I don't mean,
wrote
the
him up.
I don't mean put in the grand sense, but I mean.
Did you write our.
The cause? There's no
cause. It's a long story. It's a long story. But basically, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't do. You should resist the Saddam Hussein if he's killing people. You should fire incompetent people for hurting the company. And all that. That's all true. It's where did you think they came from? You know, we saw last week. Where does a world of nincompoops come from? You know? No, it's that dog day. It's the environmental result of must be something. I don't know. you know, not studying wisdom or something. And then you have to be surrounded by incompetent people. This is where it came from. You made it. That's why we're studying wisdom. I mean, the whole thing of environmental results. If you weren't really blown away by it, you didn't catch it. You know, all the people around you in your office are doctors, are environmental results of what you did. You know, you wouldn't have to be with them if you had collected better karma. They're coming from your karma. You would be surrounded by brilliant, you know, helpful monks and cook you lunches. And
So tonight we're back in the high school, right? We're not there.
Yeah, we definitely are in the high school. I mean, that book, there's a debate about whether it's mind only or don't worry about it. Abhidharma is anything but mind only. Abhidharma is way down in first school.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been out of Abhidharma for 2 classes now. Why? You must know these things, or you can't buy karma. If you know these things, you must buy karma, in my opinion. And then it's only a question of whether you can behave well or not, based on your knowledge. I can't do anything beyond the classroom door, you know, even for myself. Delminder is Tirchak. Based on that misperception, what do you guess happens next? Because you don't understand the guy's nature at work, and you don't understand the nature of your friend's spouse, what will you do?
You yell at it.
You'll scream at the one guy and you'll go after the other one. Okay? So Tirchak is desire. And we saw before that it's the wish not to lose something desirable, not to lose something pleasant. But the next thing that happens in this chain of events, right, is how you get in trouble, is because you've misunderstood the object. She looks pretty. You don't realize that if you touch her or something, you'll burn in hell for thousands of years. You're not thinking about it. And he looks bad and you swim at it. And the first one is Gelmindu. You don't want to lose a pleasant object. And we said many times, we talked about it before, I mean, of course, the reason you're in Buddhism class is to get out of this suffering. You want to lose an unpleasant object. Did that kind of desire come from this process?
The desire to lose an unpleasant object?
The wish to get out of samsara. It's the wish to get out of the suffering life. Did it come about through this process?
No.
Not really. I mean, it's true that your perceptions are messed up all the time. And it's true that your perception of samsara, of your own suffering, is messed up. But it's a noble desire. It's not at all this thing. It's not at all a result of this kind of chain of causation. You know, you want to reach a state where you permanently don't have these problems. This
stuff. Yeah. Okay, this relates to one of the things I was thinking about, whether the entire your entire mind is bachak kind of, or is there a part, you know, like the fight is searching for the truth, or you know.
You have bachaks, you have good bachaks.
Oh.
Bachaks don't have to be bad.
But
you're
they're not ignorant?
No. Well, ultimately they are, but they're nice ignorant. Your desire to come to class is from your attraction to Buddhism was from a bachak.
Oh.
Yeah.
Actually, the process seems pretty similar, the basic difference being the belief in a self-existent being or objects or people or what have you. If you take that part out, then the desire to achieve Buddhahood is reached the same way, right? It's just that...
But you sort of believe that Buddhahood is self-existent.
Oh, yeah. Right now, everything, as I said, you still are under the... When you think of Buddhahood, when you think of Nirvana, even when you think of emptiness, even when an Arya thinks of emptiness after he comes out of the direct perception of emptiness, his mind is screwed up. He's got a misperception. But he knows he does. Then you get Jhamdhu. Jhamdhu means what? What's the opposite of desire? It's like we call it hatred. It's called hatred. It's the snake in the middle of the Wheel of Life picture over there.
Is it number 5?
No, we're still on number 4. Sorry, I've been letting you see that.
But there's two parts to
this? Yeah, there's two. Of course there's two parts. You know that. Liking things and disliking things. Ignorantly.
Is disliking something hatred? Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is hatred, I don't agree with our translation. I think it's a very poor translation. I haven't hated anybody today. But I had shade on all day long. Forget it. You know? Of course I'm collecting karma all day long. It can even be a slight irritation with someone is this. If you misunderstand the object. Everything from slight irritation to tremendous fury in your personality is all very bad karma and very ignorant. And you wouldn't have it if you understood the objects that they were focused on.
But if your emotions...
You wouldn't have any of them.
But if you have these emotions, right?
You have to understand...
Are they supposedly that they come from the mind first? I mean, it seems to me like you're giggling, you're laughing, you know...
Well, we have it here. They're based on a misperception. The misperception came from a wrong way of, from an ignorance. The ignorance came from your past deeds and from your mind. This is the process by which you get irritated. And it's also the process by which you murder someone and be out of fury. I mean, we're talking about different degrees of the same desire to get away from something. Don't do is the desire to get away from something. This mental function that they call hatred in the books on Buddhism, desire. Come on, I didn't have desire seeing. I didn't run after some girl on the street. And I didn't have hatred or anger, you know, where I blew up at Thelma just because, well, you know. So, it wasn't like that. But I had these two emotions all day long. And very subtly, I wanted things and I didn't want things all day long. As long as I misunderstand the objects of those, they will cause me trouble. How they cause trouble, that's number 5.
Did you say attachment and aversion are accurate translations of those?
That's pretty good, but aversion is like, you know, when's the last time you had aversion?
You don't want something, you don't want it, you don't like it.
That's all right.
It's aversion.
To me, aversion is a little strong. But I have an aversion to... What is it? I don't know.
But
aversion is pretty strong. I don't know, but you can say aversion. But it's not a word that people use. You don't see it in New York Post.
then why would anybody choose to do one thing or another of Buddha?
I tried to clarify and I'll clarify it again. These are not the simple wanting to get away from something, not to lose something, and the simple wanting to get away from something. They are wanting not to lose something and wanting to get away from something based on ignorance of the object. They misunderstand the object which they're focused on. And naturally, that will make them number 5. And you know what it is.
Based on thinking that it's within the object itself and not in your own mind?
Not in the mind-only school, not in this school. In this school, based on thinking that it didn't come from your own projection. That was back in the day. So suppose, out of ignorance of the object, suppose you don't understand the asshole at work. Okay? You really don't understand his nature. And you want... to get away from him. Jhamdhu. You want to get away from him. You want to avoid him. So you will what?
Create.
Just shut him down. You know, what's it called? Put him down. You know, I mean, you'll try to do some action at the office which will permanently get him out of your way forever. And you try. You really do try. I mean, it's not that you go stabbing with a knife or something, but, you know, you try to arrange so that he gets moved out of your section or, you know, you try to discredit him with your friends. And you try to make sure he doesn't have any authority at work. And blah, blah, blah. You know, you try to just contain him because you don't like him. That's lay sock. Lay means what? karma. Sock means to collect. You collect karma. The minute you do something like that, the minute you talk back to him, the minute you answer his violence, they thought you collected karma. Yeah.
Practical sense, how do you administer a business operation when you see you have to steer a course between someone in Corinthians and you're trying to avoid it?
I like there's a famous quotation. I love it. If a person tries to do you violence, and violence can be a harsh word at work, right? Think of it, but turn it knowingly. Turn it out of self-interest. That's another story. It says, if your mother came out to you with a knife, if your mother went crazy, you know, she just took something and suddenly she freaked out and she came out with you with a knife, would you stab her? I mean, no, since it's your mother and not one of these guys out here on 9th Avenue, since it's your mother, I mean, you would watch her carefully, and when you get a chance, you'd grab her and hug her and try to get the knife away from her. You wouldn't want her. You wouldn't think to hurt her. You know, you'd even maybe let her give you a little cut if you thought you could grab her the right way and try to restrain her. And that's the idea. I mean, it doesn't mean you can't resist evil, but resist evil as if the person doing it was your mother. You really don't want to hurt her. And there may be a thing when you have to take very strong measures, but I don't think that most of the violence that people do, even in an office or militarily, is done with the conception of that Saddam Hussein is my mom. You know, you wouldn't consider that assassinating your mom for being bad. You'd just try to catch her, put her in a padded cell somewhere. You know, something done like that. Yeah.
Well, we had the example earlier of the incompetent person. So that's a less drastic example than the jerk at work, as you like to talk about.
Where did he come from?
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. So he's coming, he doesn't really exist as an incompetent person. It's really I'm describing all the
things. I never said that. Because you ascribe it, he really exists as a competent person. That's what I said.
Yes, and if we understand that, then his incompetence doesn't matter to me, but the company's still losing money. I mean, am I supposed to explain to my boss, you know, this person appears to me to be an incompetent person? You do. You know, that money appears to be going out the door, you know, but really, it's just the way it appears to us. I mean, we have to act on these appearances. Now, acting in a knowing fashion is what we're talking about tonight. I mean, as opposed to acting in a blind fashion, that person is truly incompetent, it's got nothing to do with the karma that we have to see that person, if they're acting with that person under these circumstances.
I had the same problem. I mean, I had an employee that was worse than that. Incompetent was and I wanted to yell, or I wanted to get rid of the person, or I wanted to... There's a difference between taking the proper step within the proper milieu of your culture without hurting the person. Now, there's a difference between that and you know, getting angry, hating the person, wanting to kill it, you know, wanting to cut the person out of the company, you know, wanting to get... There's a big difference between those two things. See, it's what I'm saying about your mother. If your mother came at you, right?
No, I mean,
but ultimately, that ain't the way to get rid of the person.
It's the Jimmy Carter School of Diplomacy, what he did with Ralph Nader.
I don't know. That's a great karma. But anyway,
we have to act. I mean, we have to do things.
Well, I tell you,
now we understand all this.
No, I agree.
It's true. But
the most radical thing I'm saying to you, and this, I don't want to go this far. You can't do it yet. The way to remove that person is to remove the karma that makes you see that person.
That means to stand there and get bankrupt time after time until there's nothing left to become bankrupt.
Maybe.
Yeah, well, my boss isn't going to go along.
That's desire.
How do you survive in the business world? How do you survive in the business world with your mastery and
dominance? I've been in business for a long time. You don't have to do that.
Okay. Well, most of it is. Maybe you are.
Most
of what I've found
you can be honorable, and I say in the long run, you normally get richer.
It's mathematics. It's mathematics. You can sit the person down and say, look, you're a great person. You just happen to be incompetent, and we're not going to be in business. It's just saying, nothing personal. I think you're great otherwise. You have to leave.
That's all right. You grab your mother, you stop her. You don't let her kill you. But the attitude that you have, what ultimately
this has a lot to do with motivation.
The causation of the bankruptcy of the company has nothing to do with removing that person from that.
So then don't remove him. Just stand there and watch the train wreck happen.
Do the kindest thing. Do the right thing. I mean, what we're discussing is very fundamental. It's very radical. Where did a company come from that it could be bankrupted by this person? What caused that?
Yeah, the philosophical threat that goes back a zillion, gazillion years as to, and now we're at this point, right now, you see some document that was signed the wrong way, and if you don't act, that will bankrupt the company. Now, you're going to stand there and say, gee, you know,
I said, grab your mother and stop her. You know, do it kindly. That's all right. Without violence. But ultimately, why did that occur? Why is the company such that it
that's
could be bankrupted by some one person?
Why is the company such at all? Why is any company
such
at all?
This is what we're talking about.
Right.
Ultimately, if you follow my reasoning to the ultimate end, which is what you've just done, and you try to do a tellinger, that's a problem with ego. You tried to show that it would be absurd to act that way at a certain point. It's not. I'm not suggesting.
Act what way, though? I mean, you have to act. Even not acting is an act.
Leave it like that. Imagine that every detail of your world comes from those karmas, environmental results. And the way to change the results can only be to affect the causes.
Yeah, and we're producing new causes every time we react.
So that's
to react without the ignorance of thinking that this is all happening out there concretely on its own.
Didn't say that. No, it is. We're going to talk about that.
I understand that. But to act without that still doesn't mean that you don't act with justice or with a sense of propriety to the situation.
Oh,
to
no,
the
you have to. But ultimately, where it came from and how to fix it. I'll tell you why. Now, it's very radical. Firing the person, or trying to get rid of the person, doesn't always remove the karma. Sometimes they sue you. We met a guy the other day at the restaurant, sued his boss, fired him. And sometimes it has repercussions that go way beyond what the potential loss from the person was. If removing the person with the correct means of preventing harm to the company, should it work some of the time or all of the time?
Well, the
No. All the time or some of the time? If it's
it
true,
should work all of the time, but it doesn't.
Cause. It doesn't, so that's not the true cause. Leave it, yeah.
I just wanted to get the translation for Shedang.
Yeah, Shedang means disliking something. And it's what most people translate as hatred.
And
it does mean, or anger, it does mean, there is a meaning in colloquialism to get angry.
And John?
Jundu means the desire to avoid something. Based on your misperception, you take steps to get rid of the thing you don't like in an ignorant way or an ignorant method, and that therefore you collect karma.
So it's number four that you perceive it and you take steps, or just you perceive it?
No. Number three was that you perceive the guy in the wrong way.
Then you have the attachment, the aversion.
And then you perceive that nice thing or ugly thing in the wrong way. You take it the wrong way.
It's self-existent.
You think it's coming from inside and not from your own projection. Uh-huh. Therefore, you can. Therefore, you're capable of these wrong emotions towards an object. If there ever came a day, you can twist this around. If there ever came a day that you truly understood the nature of every object around you, you would be incapable of these two emotions. You would never get angry, you would never get desire. You would never get hatred.
So it's the point that you have to act, you don't have to act. It's step four. It doesn't matter.
Action comes way out number five. Based on not understanding him or her or whatever it is, you want to avoid it in an ignorant way. And you act ignorantly. And that's called karma. That's collecting karma.
So this is saying you collect karma based upon simply the attachment
based
or aversion.
Based upon the two emotions.
You don't have to do anything. Just having the
It refers to doing. That's why it's a separate step. Because of these two emotions, which run your life, you take action. And you collect karma.
Even if you didn't take action, you would still collect karma from having that.
Technically, yeah.
Mental karma.
Who's taking action? It's these two things that cause them to be good or bad or relatively good.
Sambele and sambele, right? We had it before.
Karma,
which is the thinking, and the karma, which is the thing you think to do.
So, if you have a good, you know, you like the person, right? You're attracted to the person,
yeah.
And you do something nice for them, therefore,
yeah, yeah.
So
it's
that thing,
karma.
But that's good karma.
It's good temporary karma, temporary good results. Yeah. So then you collect karma based on that.
Nice talk means collect karma.
Based on karma, what's number six? What's the last one?
Create a box job.
We call it Kodwar Kor. Say Kodwar Kor.
Kodwar Kor.
You circle around in the circle of life. Kodwar Kor. And the word circle is the Tibetan translation of the Sanskrit word samsara. Because you collected karma, you must undergo suffering. There's suffering life. Kauruwara means in the circle. Kor means the circle. The circle around in the circle. The spin around in the wheel. And that's the whole process. You know, if you wanted to stop these classes tonight, just go home and do it. That's it. That's all you need to know. That's where it's all coming from. This is a very profound, you know, it's a Buddha thing. The Buddha giving you. That's his outline of the whole way karma is collected. How is it related to emptiness?
You understand emptiness of the noodle.
Absolutely. And I almost put a number seven because that was his next sentence. And the reason why you never understood the relationship in noodle. Relationship in noodle means the heart of it, the essence of all the good. And then in the next sentence he says that means emptiness. In the next sentence he says, and the reason all this happens is because you haven't understood emptiness, which is the essence of the Buddha. He calls it the heart of the Buddha.
And the reason is because you specifically would not have step three.
Right. Right.
To bring
yeah,
it.
That's a good point. That's probably where you bring it. The reason why these things occur. Mm-hmm. That you didn't understand emptiness. So there's where karma plays a, there's where emptiness plays a role in the collection of karma. That's very clear, okay? It's a negative role, right? Because you don't understand emptiness, this whole process can take place. And that's where emptiness and karma fit together in this negative sense. We'll take a break now, and then when you come back, we'll talk about a positive thing. And that's a very, very profound thing from Sankhya. It's a really... I'll say what it's called, the glass of water.
This is?
The next thing I need to know. This is my chance. You next get Chandrakirti talking about the glass of water. You set a glass of water down on a table, and you call a hungry, one of those craving... I call them craving spirits, hungry ghosts. And you call a person from the human realm, and you call a person from the... I call them pleasure beings. People call them deities. They're not like sacred deities. They're temporarily up for a while, they come back down later. So you take a pleasure being, a craving spirit, and a human, you put them around the table, and you put a glass of water in the middle. What happens? They all see totally different things. The human sees a glass of water. The hungry ghost sees a glass of love and pus. And the... pleasure being see the glass of ambrosia. And then what's going on there? What's that say about the emptiness of the glass of water and about the karma of the being sitting around the table? We'll talk about that when you come back. It's a famous section in Madhyamika. It's a very, very, very important part of Madhyamika, middle way. And it means when those three beings look at the same glass of liquid. The human sees water. The hungry ghost sees, the craving spirit sees pus and blood. And the pleasure being sees ambrosia.
Hungry ghost
sees pus and blood. generally, you have speaking, you have to understand what's the nature of a hungry ghost. Hungry ghost is a person who was a cheapskate in his past life. Okay? Craving things, wanting to collect things. People who couldn't control their appetite in any way. And then they take a rebirth as a person who, you cannot see them. According to Buddhism, you cannot see them. According to Buddhism, they have a very subtle form, and if they were around in this room, as they probably are, you couldn't see them.
Can they see
it? I don't think so. Well, what they see is strength, because anytime they can, generally the only thing that they, if they see a nice, cool glass of water, and they reach out for it and start to drink it, it turns into blood or pus. And then if you spit or poop or something, they can only, they have some special problem that they can only see that, they can only find that.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they can ever eat. And they have, there's certain of them that have problems. They have little tiny mouths, and they have huge stomachs, and they can, no matter how much, maybe they find some food, but they can't stuff it in fast enough to feel good. And this is all, and when they do get something and they pour it down their throats and it turns into fire and it hurts them. It's all from being, it's all from craving too much in this life.
So you mean if you're overweight like myself, I'm going to go there?
Well, I like ice cream too. I think you have to be, I think that watching, there's a very famous line by of all people in the Nagarjuna that we say as a prayer, and it says, eat to keep yourself healthy, eat to keep yourself fit, don't eat for other reasons. I mean, you have to, it's good to be moderate,
period.
It's healthy, it tastes better, and, you know, this is a precious body, you shouldn't damage it. If you overfed it, you're going to damage it. You shouldn't, you have to take care of it. If it gave you a heart attack, or if it made your life shorter, it would be, dharmically, it would be irresponsible. You have to help a lot of people. You can't die quickly. You have to stay. As long as this body can stay around, you have to do the best thing you can to feed it properly.
Why do you live offerings to hungry ghosts?
Why to do it? If you do a certain prayer, supposedly they can actually see it when they couldn't see it before. And there's all different kinds of offerings. But that's a long story. So that's the three kinds of beings. We're looking at the same thing. So there's all this argument. You know, I got into it. I translated a whole section. That's why it's 31 pages long. It's too much for you. I mean, there's this whole argument between the mind-only school, and you can read it, but don't get lost in it. You know, if you're really into it, spend 4 or 5 days and read it slowly. It's a debate. It's in a very difficult. It's a dialectic. It's two people debating with each other. So you'll read the whole thing. But at some point, what's nice is you get all the objections that a person would normally have. You know, so one person comes up and says, well, then nothing, you can't say that anything is really anything at all. You know, you can't say that anything is one way or another way. Because if someone looks at it, it's going to be good. If somebody looks at it, it's going to be bad. The guy at work is nothing, you can't say he's good or bad. You can't say anything in the world is good or bad. You know? And then the debate that goes back to him is, you would think it's kind of parochial.
Parochial.
But it's the Buddhists, they say, well, then are you saying that there's no difference between Buddhism and other beliefs? No, are you saying it's all the same? You say it doesn't matter what you believe? And are you saying the Buddha is the same as every other person who ever lived? You know, any other teacher around, you're the same, there's no difference. And what he said is not something much better, or the Buddhism, the pure Buddhism is not something that's very important and much better than other, you know, less correct beliefs. Then are you saying there's no such difference? And the person says, well, I didn't, you know, he flip-flops on that. And then they quote, just so you know, the quotation that comes in the book, in the reading, where it says, oh, now I understand the Buddha is a great teacher, I understand that Buddhism is correct. You will see that, by the way, when you see emptiness directly. I mean, a few seconds after coming out, you realize that every Buddhist book you ever read was correct. And that's something you can't know until that time. And I can say it and it doesn't matter. You have to see it. But in the meantime, there's this quotation in the reading. Whose quotation is that? They don't say, but you should know. It's in the Tengyur. It's in the canon, and it was written by a Hindu who had criticized the Buddha, and then he changed his mind, and that was written by him. So it's not like some Buddhist, it's not like showing off to ourselves that we're great at, it actually was written by a non-Buddhist who became a Buddha. Yeah.
So what the Buddha has to say is self-existently great.
No, I didn't say that.
Huh?
I didn't say that.
Well, then its greatness depends on the person perceiving. So in that
sense, does that mean that the teaching is neither great nor not? Is it great or not?
Well, you seem to be implying that it's self-existently great.
Well, that's what the Veda says, and the other guy says, no, it's not. It's self-existently great?
If it's not,
if you follow it, you get a good result. If you don't follow it, you get a bad result. I don't know. Function. That's what he's saying. So think about it. These debates are very, you can read them for long, you can read them for 10 years, 15 years, and you still have these. You call sinsums. Sinsums means, where do you draw the line? You know, what's the truth? It's very difficult. But the point of the monastic textbooks is that they bring up all the difficult things. They don't just avoid them. They dig into the difficult points. They leave the easy points out. You won't find them in there. They bring up all the tough questions. So anyway, I'm just telling you what the book says. You got to cook it. If someone comes up to you and says, because of your beliefs about emptiness, then is it correct to say that nothing is one way or the other? You say, well, according to the book, it says Buddhism is better than no Buddhism. It works that way. Does that contradict the idea of emptiness? No. You got to cook it.
So what is Chubap?
Chubap is a study. Chumbap is a whole class that you do in the monastery. It might take you 8 weeks or 12 weeks, and it's dedicated to the idea of this glass of water. Chumbap means a stream, and there's a quotation from the scriptures. It talks about a stream of water, and when a hungry spirit comes up and looks at it, he sees blood. He doesn't see it as a nice fresh.
So what did the Buddha see?
Paradise.
When he looks at his glass of water, he doesn't believe in it.
Well, he understands that it's only empty.
Can he choose what he wants to see then?
In a certain sense? He can see what we think we see. He knows that. But no, he's forced to have a perception of it as ultimate pleasure. And a glass of water for him gives him the ultimate pleasure that you could ever have.
So he's not free in a certain way.
No, not at all. He's at the mercy of his own good karma.
So there is no such thing as a free being.
No, not free karma. You're a willing captive of your good karma and forced to see the world as an endless karma.
Well, since you've got on this fascinating subject of the karma of the Buddhist, then the Buddha is producing more good karma all the time as well, right?
Well, he also he dedicates everything, and then he has to have more. And that's, by the way, the trick of staying with it. Okay. So that's the Chumbap. Now, that was the first debate that comes up in it. And if we had time, we should debate it. Second debate is this. Are all those beings having a prominence? That's a very difficult question. You know, if you accept the emptiness of that glass of water, what are you going to say to this person who comes up to you and says, well, are all three beings having a prana? What's a prana?
Valid perception.
Now, in Madhyamika Prasadika, we got to start saying valid perception. Correct is a little tricky here. Valid perception. Is it correct? Is it really what they're seeing? Is what they're seeing, are they seeing it the right way? Mm-hmm. Are they all having a prana?
Yes.
No, not yet.
Wait, what do you say?
Well, you said that only the Buddha can have a prana.
All the time.
Well, a Buddha is an ultimately prominent person. He always has, he only has prana. But we have pranas all the time. 99% of your perceptions are pranas. You know, the only non-pranas you ever have are when you're very jealous of some friend of your husband and you think they're out after him and they actually don't care at all. But your own jealousy makes you see something, you know. Or you someone's competing with you at work and you impute all this stuff on them that's not even true at all. But it does extraordinary cases. You're driving a car and a leaf comes across and you think it's a squirrel and you slam on the brake. Those are non-permanent. But most of what you do is permanent all day long. So are they permanent?
Yes.
But there's a principle about permanent. If two... You can't have two prominent towards one object, or someone's competing with you at work, and you impute all this stuff on them. It's not even true at all. But that's extraordinary cases. You're driving a car, and a leaf comes across, and you think it's a squirrel, and you slam on the brake. Those are non-prominent. But most of what we do is prominent all day long. So are they prominent?
Yes.
But there's a principle about prominent. If two... You can't have two prominent towards one object, which are seeing it differently. There's no such thing possible. It's either water or blood. To be water, to be blood, are contradictory qualities. It's got to be one or the other.
I thought the idea was that prominent was relative to each person.
Or class in this case. Class of being.
No.
So it's not... A prominent for me, which is different than your prominent, the same event.
No. Prominent can't be contradictory. I can't perceive it as water, and you perceive it as not water. And we can have both be having a prominent. It's impossible.
So we're seeing it
so
as
what's going on? Now, this is very interesting.
We're seeing it as a fluid.
And according to Chandrakirti, you've got to ask these questions. You have to understand what's going on when the three beings look at the water. It's impossible for three beings to look at a glass of liquid and all see something contradictory and all of them be having a problem. It's impossible for me to look at a wall and see it as yellow and you look at it and see it as red and one of us is not mistaken. It's not possible.
I need to do an interpretation.
No, with the emptiness of the... With its emptiness.
Well, the way... Now we got to get to the next thing. This is very common. How do we explain that what's going on there? It's very difficult. Okay, there's this glass of water, glass of liquid. Okay. The way they explain it is this. It's very difficult. We had Nirnagi Gyu and we had Tenji Kishin when we talked about prominence. The cause of mind. The cause of the first moment of your mind and your mind's prominence. What was the Nirnagi Gyu? What was that? Remember? The stuff that turned into your mind. It had to be, no, wait, that's the, the stuff that went on and then dropped over into your mind was mind itself. And that's called a material cause. So you have to talk about material cause. What's happening when the three beings look at the glass of water, glass of liquid? Material cause, you know, what was the stuff that the water came from?
The rain.
Okay. Water. I mean, liquid, water. That was the material. When I say material cause, I mean, what stuff was it to come from? Water.
According to us.
Yeah. Actually, in all three cases. But then we talk about it. And then you
Michael, do you mean water or liquid?
Well, the person who wrote the commentary kind of uses them. He sort of tends towards liquid towards the end. By the way, he calls liquid wet and flowing, right? So don't worry when you see that in the translation. That's the Tibetan word for liquid. Contributing factor. The contributing factor in this case, what do you guess? What's this course about?
Karma.
The karma of each being. The different karma of each being. So let's talk about the human. When the human sees the water, when he sees a glass of water, where did the water come from? What was the water a few minutes ago?
Water.
Water. And then water provided the stuff that turned into the water that he's now seeing. And his karma gets into the act and causes what we call a contributing factor. It causes him to see the water as water. Causes him to see water.
And is that a valid perception?
Yes.
Yeah.
And what they say is, this is the catch, okay? And it has to be this way. And this is just, I'm just saying this because you have to, in your mind, understand karma. You have to understand why the guy looks bad to you and looks good to the other person. At the moment that those three beings look at the liquid, when those three beings from three different backgrounds karmically look at the liquid, there's three parts to the liquid. At that moment, when the three beings start looking at the liquid, it now has three parts. One part is acting as the material cause for water, and the contributing factor is the human being's karma, and the result of both of those, the result of those two causes, what? One third of the water appearing to him, the third of the water that appears, the part of the water that appears, the part of the liquid that appears to him, and his own karma get together causally, and the result is what? He sees water. And that's the process. Did the water have three parts 10 minutes before the three beings came into the room? No.
But why does it have three parts? I don't know.
Why does it need three parts?
It doesn't make any sense.
Where's the water? One part is going to that. The one part of the three is acting as a material cause. It's what turns into the water that the human sees as he sits around the table. The water has to have three parts. Why? I'll give you two good reasons, all right? No, this is very serious. This is what's going on with the guy at work. It's not a light thing. And if you don't explain it this way, you can't explain it. The water cannot be, one object cannot be water, blood, and ambrosia at the same time. It's impossible.
But one object can't be three different things either.
It can't. No, it cannot. There's even another reason
why
that...
You say it has three parts. I mean, what do you mean by that?
He says, in the same way that you have an arm and leg and a head, and your arms and your legs and your head can all be performing a different function, and then you say, well, that person is performing five different functions.
So there's three different functions that are going on.
There's three different parts.
So when the Buddha drinks a glass of ambrosia, he just doesn't taste the part that's pus, but it's there.
If there's no preta, if there's no hungry ghost sitting with him at the table, there is no second part.
And then you're saying that the perception is going to influence.
By the way, the other thing they say, Harley, is that when the hungry ghost reaches out for the glass of liquid and he touches it to his lips, it no longer has two parts. It's blood.
Well, to them, but if the human's looking at it at the same time...
If it's a common object of three different beings, it has two parts.
Alright,
so... When it ceases to be a common object and becomes the object of only one of them, it only has one part. It's
okay,
only
so,
blood.
So you have, Michael, you have a...
So you're talking about whether the object is held, is shared by three beings or not. When the object is shared simultaneously by three beings, it has three parts.
Alright.
And as soon as one of those beings starts to partake of it himself, and the other, you could say the other two look away.
But what do you mean by
the white blood?
What do you mean by the part?
Well, in the same way that your arms and your head are parts of your body.
Yeah, but there's a distinct physical separation. There's no distinct physical separation in water.
He doesn't say.
No, they're connected by your body.
Water is physical.
You have one preta, you have one god, and you have 10 humans looking at the glass. Are there now 12 parts?
Yeah.
Or are there three because of the three different classes?
12 parts and 10 of them are looking at the same.
So there's an infinite amount of parts to any object depending on how many beings are looking at it.
But does the part exist in the water, or does the part where does the part exist?
It's part of the water.
It exists in
the
water.
Glass of water. It exists. The glass of water has three parts as soon as the three beings focus on it.
I don't understand.
It ceases to have three parts as soon as three people stop looking at it.
It also has two parts if one being's looking at the top part of it or the bottom part of it. Right?
Different. Those are different parts. Uh-huh. Different kinds of parts.
You said the first part is the material cause, the second one is the contributing factor, what's the third one?
Thank you. Yeah, right. The first one is the third one is the fact that it has three parts.
What do you call that factor?
Say that again?
There's three things contributing to this perception. One is the fact that there's three parts there now. As soon as three different beings are looking at it, there's three parts to the water, to the liquid.
To the liquid itself.
And as soon as they, one, as soon as two of them walk out of the room, and one of them picks it up, so it's not got three parts.
Well, what disappears then? Is it the material cause or the contributing factor?
The only way to explain the fact that, by the way, all three perceptions are valid.
It's like an accounting fudge
really
factor
is,
they have on
it really
balance
is blood,
sheets, right?
It really is water, and it really is ambrosia.
But what if there's other things?
Is it one thing, which is three things at once? No. It has two parts.
If there's a glass of water and three people are looking at it, one has blue glasses on, one has red glasses on, and one has green glasses on, do we say that the water simply has three parts, is it the blue part, or do we just say it's all the same thing, it's just the perspective of the onlooker that makes it
well, what is
if
it?
They're different? Why do we have to all of a sudden split the water into three parts, one blue, one green, and one
red? It's not water. What are you splitting it?
Now, why do we have to go so far as to impute it onto the glass of water, and why can't we say it's just the conception that's being labeled upon it by the onlooker?
He gets into that later. I mean, he says, he talks about a preza which comes up to a stream, and he starts to drink, and then suddenly all he sees is a dry riverbed. Was there a stream there that he doesn't see as a stream, or what's going on? And then you'll get it. You should read the reading. You have to read the reading. Okay, there's some more details about it. But I'm trying to explain to you what the highest schools, this is what they say. This is China. And this is what they say is going on when
so
two people...
I never understood that it was a valid perception. I mean, only in a conventional, what, you know, I mean, I always thought when you said prominent...
Well, what is it really?
Nothing. Empty. No? Isn't it?
It's empty, but it's something.
It is something,
it's empty
but
of its own nature. It has no nature of its own.
I don't understand how...
So because it has no nature of its own, you would think that the Holy Ghost could see it as blood.
Correctly.
It's
and it's genuine blood at that moment. Absolutely.
I don't understand how having three parts makes it a valid perception.
Then you don't have one thing being three things at once.
How? So what do you have?
You have one thing with three parts, and each part is being something different to a different
thing. So each person is... perceiving a different aspect of that same object? Is that what you're saying?
No.
What you're saying?
Yeah, you could say that. Different
each person is
a
different
perceiving
part.
A different part of the object. You could say that. They also say it's different. You have to cook it. I mean, I'm just telling you what's on the drinking point. And it's true. And you have to raise these questions, or else you can't figure out what emptiness is.
So then you're saying every, you know, in this case, a glass of water has the potential to have a part
of
pus, blood, nectar, water.
As many as there are karmas.
So to extrapolate that, every existing thing has the potential to be pain, pleasure, pus,
yeah.
Blood,
yeah.
Nectar.
Yeah.
This may be mixing apples and oranges, but last week we learned that the mind is the main cause of the world. And now we're learning that the mind is a contributing factor.
Yeah, right. And they ask that question too. It comes at the end. Shanti Deva, and quote Shanti Deva. Shanti Deva says, the mind, no one made the hell. In fact, you're supposed to memorize it for your homework. Nobody made hell, nobody made heaven. You made it. Your mind made hell. Your mind made hell. So they say, well, how could it be? If the mind is the maker, they get into that problem, and then they say, well, Shantideva was trying to say there's no creator, God.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't trying to say that it wasn't, that it doesn't exist, or that it's just an illusion or something like that.
But I just mean, in what sense is it a contributing factor here? Because it sounds like a secondary...
Oh, they're talking about the cause of the water. I mean, Prasangika, the higher school, says water, what turned into water was the past water, was the liquid.
Mm-hmm.
What made the water appear, the liquid appear one way or the other is your karma. That's all. They're not saying that the water itself comes from a nirlinky view, a material cause of mind.
Would the mind-only school
mind
say that?
Mind does not turn into physical memory.
But the mind-only school would say that, right?
Oh, they'd say there is no physical memory. Outside the mind. But we're talking Majjhimika school. So what they're trying to get out of the problem that, and they do, that mind cannot turn into physical stuff. the physical stuff came from some physical stuff from before. The reason it looks like water to you and is water to you, and is validly water to you, is your own karma.
But why use such a complicated example? If you just use the example of the boss at work and how the boss is perceived differently by his
friends, that's a good question. You see, it's very valid, it's very important, and it's very difficult. If I see the boss as bad, and you see the boss as good, and we both have valid perceptions, he can't be both good and bad. He cannot be. Those are contradictory qualities. And yet, what we have towards him is a pramana. It's correct. Anything established by a pramana what? Exists. That's the definition of existence. If I see it and I'm not crazy, it exists.
So the boss is
so how can there be a
parts?
Bad boss and a good boss?
The boss is part both, is what you're saying now.
Yeah, there's a part of the boss that
turns. So up to now, we've been saying the boss is, just, you know, is empty, can't be both. Now we're saying it has to be both.
He is both. I didn't say he is both. He has a good part and a bad part.
Well, it has to be composed of both.
The water, the liquid is not simultaneously blood, ambrosia, and water. One part acts as a material cause. The karma of that person acts as a contributing factor. And he sees blood. And it is blood.
So the same thing is true of the boss. One part of the boss is the material cause,
right.
And your karma is a contributing factor.
Right.
Anything about that. There has to be some bad bossness in there to be the material boss.
Okay. Let me make sure I do that. What is, it says here, what happens to the three parts when the craving spirit starts to drink their stuff?
We hope the other two walk out of the room.
No, it no longer has two parts.
Yeah, but which parts? Which two parts disappear then?
You said the one
parts.
That the human was, the one that was acting as the cause for what the human saw, and the one that was acting as the cause for what the god saw, deity saw, are no longer there.
So
what are you
left with? The contributing factor?
You no longer have three parts. It's only one part. It's only one thing. It's blood.
So suddenly the human and the deity see blood. Also.
They're gone.
No, when they're not gone. Oh.
No, we're assuming, when we say walked out, we say they're not looking at it anymore.
So what if they are looking at it?
Then it has three parts.
Even when he touches it to drink it.
As a visual object, three parts. As a drinking object, one part. How's that?
Because they're not all drinking
when
at the same
it.
Time.
You're right.
They're all
not share it to their
tongue.
What if they all had a straw?
Right.
Yeah, but one straw would be poking down into one side.
That's hard to do
down
into the other
side. You'd
have
to have that's one straw.
Oh, then how do you explain it?
Ends on
it. How do you? It has to.
Well, I never
cook
got
it.
I guess, I mean.
Cook it. No, you never, nobody ever got this far with you. That's what's bothering.
Well, I know. I guess the whole idea of content is something is a valid perception. You know, I thought it just in a conventional
not
way.
Not at all. He has a pramana. It's real blood. By the way, the last question is it real blood and pus? Is the answer.
Yeah.
It is. He has a pramana towards it.
Okay,
not only that, it functions as blood and pus. Blood and pus. What does that mean? If you have to go.
I
want to
go.
Go. Okay. Go.
Okay.
You guys you gotta go. Okay. So if it's acting as blood and pus, it is really blood and pus. And there's two reasons why. There's a prominence towards blood and pus. It's a correct valid perception. They're seeing blood and pus. That's the first reason. And the second reason is it's functioning as blood and pus. How does blood and pus function to a treta?
As water to us.
Yeah, he drinks it. And what happens when he drinks it?
It burns
him like fire. I mean, even if he finds it, it burns him.
But on the other hand, we find blood and pus to be something unpleasant to drink, and so does the preta.
Oh, yeah.
So that's in common. That part's not different, right? We would both say, ew. You know, it's just that we wouldn't drink it, and they
have no
choice.
Blood and pus.
I understand that, but the concept of blood and pus is equally repulsive.
Oh, very repulsive. It's repulsive to them. When they first see the river, it's pure water. And when they run up to it, it's blood and pus. And they're
so as different as the parts might be, we agree on one thing, that they're unpleasant.
No, the human thing is a very pleasant part.
How can they be?
No, give me another choice. No, go ahead. Let's do it. Debate.
How can it function? Can we finish maybe and then debate? Yeah.
That's all. That's all I have to do. I'll give you homework. But then, if you want to debate it, which you, I'm quite happy. that one reason that I did the whole reading was that hopefully among all of us. They get like 20 debates come. And I think if you read all 20 of those, you get some insight. That's what happens. You have to explain it. If you don't explain it, then...
I just don't see it as science. Now you can claim three different things that are equally the same. They're not the same. Blood is not made of the same substance as water. It's more of an explosion. Blood is not made of the same substances chemically as water.
No, not at all.
So how can they be valid?
That's what he's trying to explain. It cannot be one thing which is three different.
No, valid means functionally valid. Doesn't
it cannot be.
Valid.
And by the way, in another argument, since you want to say, water is a total. Tokje means if I have the computer here and I want to put this in the same space, the computer has to go out. So if there's blood in a cup and you want water to be in the cup, the blood has to leave the cup. It can't coexist in the same space at the same time. That's the nature of it. So what's going on? It is real blood. It is real water.
How can it be both?
It isn't both. And it's not one thing, it's three parts.
But then it sounds like anything could be anything, and it just depends on your perception of it.
Well,
yeah.
Then,
that's right.
Then get into that debate also. Well, that's the whole point.
And
let me do the last one.
Where does your perception come from?
What's the whole point of doing all this? What's the whole point? Well, I mean, we said before, the big ignorance is the one that focuses on you. John Stilwell's ignorance focusing on John Stilwell. The thing that you really don't like and the thing that you really do like is about yourself. You want to be able to... How do you get rid of the guy at work is not such a big question as how do you get rid of the cancer that's going to come into you or the senility or the loss of your health and your happiness and your good looks. How do you stop that? It's tied up with the question of the glass of water. I mean, ultimately, the way you become a Buddha is that you just perceive yourself. And then it has to... You are providing the material cause. And your karma is going to provide the contributing factor that makes you see yourself as a Buddha. And that's all. That's the key. That's the clue. And how will other people see you?
Some people see you as a Buddha, some people see you as a jerk.
Yeah, they might want to nail you up on a cross or something. I mean, I hate your guts, you know. Or they might want to shoot a big rock at you, which is what the Buddha's brother tried to kill him.
So you're saying becoming a Buddha is a question of seeing yourself as a Buddha.
Absolutely.
So
and that's all there ever was to anything else.
And so, and the idea is by seeing yourself as a Buddha...
By being forced to see a blank self as a Buddha, by being qualified.
Oh, this is different than volunteering to see yourself as
no,
a Buddha.
No, if you could volunteer, we wouldn't have such long classes.
You have to volunteer yourself first. You have to build on it.
All right, okay. So I'm sorry to keep you. I can see it coming where we spend too much time. Sanye
This is the end of Class 6.